Colleen Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we have a new way of enjoying food, looking at how foods get their names with linguist Martha Barnett, author of Ladyfingers and Nun's Tummy. Yes, there is a part of the world where you can have a nun's tummy for dessert. Martha will reveal Pumpernickel's dirty little secret and how a drunken brawl gave us Lobster Newburgh. Jane and Michael Stern, our hungry travelers, have discovered a St. Louis specialty, gooey butter cake. Our maverick wine expert, Joshua Wesson, answers the question, what do you drink with the problem children of spring? Tea maven Bill Waddington has a tasting of oolong teas, and it's open lines for your calls. All this and more coming up on The Splendid Table. First, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, Party Giving 101. This is a lineup of some of the best one-pot party dishes that I can think of. Now, these aren't recipes, but they're ideas to trip off your imagination and some thoughts on the best cookbooks to go to if you want guidance. The idea of the one-pot party is that you make a single dish, ideally a do-ahead one, and then all you need is a salad, some good bread, and maybe you ask guests to bring the appetizers and the dessert. Nothing needs to be fancy here because the one-pot dish is going to be pretty substantial. To set the casual tone of the party and get people mixing, have everybody help themselves right from the kitchen stove. You could have places laid at a table or just have people eat from their laps. But remember one thing about eating from your lap. For this style, serve one-pot dishes that are easy to eat with just a fork or a spoon and nothing that's too liquid. Of course, if you've got a table to eat off of, then you can serve just about anything. Another great thing about the one-pot party dish is that you don't have to worry about getting everything out on time. You've done it all ahead. From the cooking point of view, doing just one dish is almost a zen experience. Focusing on cooking just one dish brings out the pleasure of cooking. The pressure's off. You can work at your own pace. You have a chance to think about how ingredients come together. See how flavors build and experience the sensuality of what you're doing. The aroma of the sautéing onions, how a crisp green bean sounds when you snap it. I think you get the idea. Okay, now for some thoughts for feasts in a pot. Let's move around the globe for some traditional dishes. There's going to be a running theme here, and it's one you're going to find in a lot of older cultures. We're using grains or noodles or legumes or vegetables, with meats only as flavorings. They're not going to be the main event. It's a lot healthier way to eat. The first one-pot meal that comes to mind for me is the spectacular cassoulet from southwest France. This is dried beans cooked in a garlicky sauce that's been flavored with duck or goose, or maybe even lamb. The beans are kind of a production number. In fact, the whole dish is. But the great thing about it is that you can make it over several days. In fact, you can even get your friends in on the act. And a little cassoulet goes a very long way. For authenticity, nobody beats Paula Wolfert's book on the foods of southwest France. Now, this isn't a quick dish. But if you want to have some fun, serve cassoulet. I can't think of anything that's more luscious. Still in France is the all-time great fish stew, bouillabaisse. Now, this is easier than cassoulet and a lot lighter. All you have to do is sauté lots of aromatics, like lots and lots of garlic, onions, some fresh fennel, orange peel. Then you add saffron, tomatoes, herbs, white wine. You do that all ahead. And then you just cook the fish at the last minute. In the south of France, where bouillabaisse comes from, every cook has their own formula. Many people buy a whole fish, and they take the bones and the head, and they make a broth out of that for the bouillabaisse, and then they cook the fillets into the stew later. For one of the best bouillabaisse recipes you're ever going to try, see Lulu's Provençal Table by Richard Olney. Now let's go to Vietnam. This is a meal that everybody cooks for themselves right at the table. You put a pot of bubbling broth in the center of the table. It could be on a hot plate or could be in a chafing dish. And this could be something like a chicken broth you've made with some fresh ginger and scallions. And then the idea is that you have all these raw ingredients set out on plates around that pot and seasoning sauces. And everybody just cooks everything the way they want them and eats them over rice noodles. You do it all ahead. It's fresh and light, and it's utterly delicious. So typically what you'd have out is some raw seafoods like thin sliced fillets, small shrimps, and scallops. You'd have that bowl of rice noodles, which is really easy to do. You just soak them in hot water, drain them, rinse them with cold water, and they're ready. You'd have what's called a table salad in Vietnam, a platter that's piled high with fresh bean sprouts, salad greens, and fresh herbs like coriander, mint, and basil, with wedges of lime, and maybe some hot chilies. And then you'd have dipping sauces. So those are just a few ideas for the one pot party. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show about food, enjoying it, buying it, cooking it, and about eating out, entertaining, health, and travel. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed is one of the largest bridal registries in the country, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. We eat pastries called nun's tummies. We say we fritter away the time. We call someone who isn't playing with a full deck a chowderhead, and pumpernickel, as in bread, describes a bodily function. Today we're talking with Martha Barnett, a linguist with a passion for etymology. That's the study of the origins of words. She's written Lady Fingers and Nun's Tummies, a lighthearted look at how foods get their names. Our favorite wine entrepreneur, Joshua Wesson, is searching out which wines taste best with spring foods. Now, if you've always heard you can't drink wine with artichokes and asparagus, stay tuned. Joshua has a new take on this old saw. Tea maven Bill Waddington is setting up a tasting of oolong teas for us. This is part of his ongoing project to get us up to speed on some tea basics. And as we do every week, the second half of the show is all yours. We're opening the lines for your calls at 800-537-5252. So let's kick things off with Jane and Michael Stern, who roam the countryside looking for good homestyle eating. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Michael, I'm bored, and you guys always go to such interesting places. So come on, tell me where you've been.
What you need to do is to go to the Lake Forest Pastry Shop in St. Louis, Missouri, and order yourself a gooey butter cake. I promise you will not be bored if you get one of these.
Gooey butter cake? What's
You'll
gooey
be
butter
busy
cake?
Going into sugar shock, Lynn, to be bored.
Gooey butter cake is the strangest thing. We had never heard of it until we went to St. Louis. It's a cake that allegedly was invented many years ago when a baker mixed the wrong ingredients but decided to bake it anyway. And out came a kind of coffee cake with a dry, sort of crusty circumference, but an interior that is almost like custard, hence gooey.
Ooh.
And it is traditionally served with coffee in the morning.
But this is an only in St. Louis thing. You know, St. Louis, as I think we've talked with you about before, is a great place for regional specialties. I mean, that's where to go to get a pig snoot sandwich or a fried brain sandwich. I mean, they have some very interesting egg foo young sandwiches. But this is a very genteel, ladylike specialty, gooey butter cake. It's not anything like snoot's brains or egg foo young sandwiches.
I'm relieved to hear this, but it sounds almost like it's undercooked cake batter. Is that what it is?
In fact, when you cook it, the directions are stick a knife in the center and the cake will test undone. And that is what it's like, except It's hard to describe. It does have the quality of being cooked and yet not quite set. It's a very subtle thing, and you have to be a good baker to do it correctly. Otherwise, what you get is undone cake. And at the Lake Forest Pastry Shop, these people are experts.
It's kind of a streusel-y consistency, which, of course, makes it wonderful with a cup of dark coffee.
This sounds great. What's the place like?
That's really just the greatest part of it.
To go to the Lake Forest Pastry Shop, first of all, you're going back in time a few decades. You take a number. The staff, they're all like sort of very clean, tidy ladies in white uniforms.
With, as Michael said, buttercream complexions.
And they speak very quietly. They say, "What would you like today?" And you tell them what you'd like today. And the selection is bundt cakes, cupcakes, tea cakes, coffee cakes, round cakes, square cakes, every kind of cake imaginable. Donuts, raised donuts, everything like that. And you take a number, and there's a kind of hush in the waiting room. It reminds me of waiting outside a doctor's office in the sense that there's a kind of anticipation. Everyone's a little nervous. You're waiting, and then finally you get your nice little white box tied with string and walk out with your gooey butter cake.
Is it like a typical bakery? I mean, are there counters and display cases, or do you actually go in, give your order, and sit there and wait in a room where you can't see anything?
It is a typical bakery. A bakery that is sensational in that it looks like a Wayne Thiebaud painting of shelves with coconut angel food cakes and triple layer chocolate cakes. But the waitresses or the counter ladies are sort of like the waitresses that used to be at Schraft's in the good old days in the little white uniforms. I mean, they are very nurse-like. I think Michael is right. It's like a Swiss clinic of cakes instead of pain.
And you have to realize that St. Louis, maybe because of its strong German heritage, is a city that is really seriously into bakeries. There was, not so long ago, somebody did a count, and there were over 500 bakeries in the city of St. Louis. So this is a place that takes baked goods very seriously.
I have to say, Lynn, also, I have been recently driven absolutely mad by room tone in places with this, horrible forced music or rock and roll that blasts everywhere. And I think one of the things that I loved about the Lake Forest Pastry Shop is that it's utterly quiet, and all you hear are the sound of these nurse, clinician, counter ladies sort of walking around on their orthopedic rubber-soled shoes getting you your cake. It was very soothing. It was like a Thomas Mann bakery.
Well, I'm not bored anymore. Thank you, guys.
I walked in, I sat down, took my customary look around. I saw a fine young thing heading straight my way, and before I could think of something slick to say, she smiled, sat down, and said, "Yes, you may." She was slapping the cakes on me, my friend. Slapping the cakes on me. She was slapping the cakes on me, my friend. Slapping the cakes on me.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA and Chili Nation. They're here every week, and you can find their restaurant discoveries on our website every week at splendidtable.org. Wine entrepreneur Joshua Wesson is a man with an irreverent streak and a great gift for unraveling the mysteries of wine. He stops by on a regular basis. Hi, Josh.
How are you?
I'm okay. What's been on your mind?
Food and foods from the season of renewal. I mean, I renewed my subscription to Stereophile.
Uh-huh.
I renewed my subscription to WNYC. And now I'm renewing my interest in foods like asparagus and artichokes and morels.
So spring food. Spring food.
Exactly. Spring foods.
The two problem children for me at this time of year are asparagus and artichokes.
Absolutely. You know, if you look in a lot of the traditional wine and food pairing guides, they'll say avoid wines with asparagus or avoid wines with artichoke dishes because those vegetables can cause problems for wines. They actually change the taste of certain wines.
Okay.
And that can be a problem if you don't know how to deal with it, but if you understand what the difficulties are, it's very easy to match wine to asparagus and artichokes.
So what are the difficulties? I'll bite.
Well, artichokes have a chemical called cinarin, which actually makes whatever you taste after eating the artichoke seem sweeter. If you were to take a sip of water and then bite into a leaf of an artichoke and then take the water again, the water would taste like you put sugar in it.
Huh.
So if you're pairing wine with an artichoke, you have to take this sweetening effect into account. And the way to match wine to artichoke dishes is to find wines that aren't very fruity, that are high in acid, that have no wood on them, usually white wines, and that are crisp, clean, lemony wines that get enhanced and filled out by that cinarin and the artichoke.
So what would some of those wines be?
Well, I really love Muscadet from the Loire Valley. I also like Sauvignon Blancs from New Zealand and Sauvignon Blancs from South Africa, and very dry, bone-dry white wines from the Mosel that are made from a grape called Riesling but have no sugar in them. Most people think of Rieslings as being sweet, but in fact, you can get dry ones, and they're crisp and clean and magnificent with artichoke dishes.
Mm. Why not any Sauvignon Blancs from California, for instance?
Well, Sauvignon Blancs from California tend to be a little bit richer and riper and more fruity than Sauvignon Blancs from France or other places. And that fruit will suggest sweetness. And when you have an artichoke, you'll up the ante to the point where you can make a Sauvignon Blanc from California taste like an off-dry wine. You don't want that to happen.
Aha, okay. What about asparagus then?
Asparagus has a kind of pungence, and a lot of asparagus dishes have some kind of acidic element in them, either from lemon juice or vinaigrette dressing. And you can take a wine and substitute the wine for the sauce and find a wine that's very similar in style to the wines that go with artichokes, but maybe with a little bit more fruit to them. And here's where Sauvignon Blancs from California can really do a great job. I think they're unbelievably good with asparagus dishes, and I think I'm going to have some after we're through with one another.
This is sounding awfully good. What about salmon?
Well, salmon is, of course, a fish that comes in many different styles, and right now they're running upstream, heading back home to mate. And I think that salmon, because of its fatty flesh and yet its firm texture, is a perfect fish to go with red wine, especially red wines that are a little bit on the fruity side.
Hmm.
So I think about lighter reds, things like Beaujolais or Gamay, anything that doesn't have a lot of tannin but has a lot of fruit and just enough acidity to cut through the fish oil like a McCullough chainsaw.
Uh-huh. Do you have a favorite spring food?
Well, I like to run through the forest naked and look for wild mushrooms. That's what makes me happy.
Do you have a bottle of wine in your hand when you're doing
that? I have to, because it's the only way that I can not feel self-conscious. And all those cool ferns tickling your rear, it's just, it can be a very interesting experience. But when I trip across wild mushrooms like morels, I immediately synapse to a red wine made from Pinot Noir, because the Pinot Noir grape tends to produce wines that are on the earthy side, and morels, of course, are the ultimate expression of earth. It's like planet Earth to Pinot Noir, come in.
And they taste nutty too. I mean, they do
taste nutty.
Yeah.
And when you stick a Pinot Noir in a barrel for a year, you can bring out some of that toastiness of the barrel, and you get the toasty, nutty side of the wine with the earthy side of the wine hooking up with the toasty, nutty elements in the morels and the earthiness of the morel. It's one of those a priori. I think you can't go wrong with Pinot Noir and morels.
Joshua, thank you for leaving us with such a strong image of you in the woods with the morels and the Pinot Noir. Hey, we'll talk soon.
Avert your eyes.
Joshua Wesson is the creator of bestsellers Wine Shops. You can find Joshua's inspired spring wine picks on the Omnipresent website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, lady fingers and nun's tummies, an oolong tea tasting with our tea man Bill Waddington, and your calls. Get on the line. The number is 1-800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week. Find them online at Target.com. Today we have a new approach for the ultimate enjoyment of food, taking a look at how foods got their names. It's a bit like fairy tales. Martha Barnett is a linguist with a passion for etymology, the study of the origins of words. She's written Lady Fingers and Nun's Tummies, a lighthearted look at how foods got their names. Just as an example of the fun you can have with this, listen up. Turkey got its name from a geographical mix-up. The Tootsie of Tootsie Rolls was the daughter of the candy's creator. And Spanish speakers sometimes say when someone's newly deceased, she's folded her napkin. We talked with Martha Barnett about how her infatuation with food names began.
Well, once I started looking into the names of foods, I really found that they were almost as delicious as the foods themselves. And if you know the origin of a food name, it can add a whole other layer of enjoyment to eating and drinking.
Can you give me an example?
Some of my favorite food names have to do with foods that are named for various parts of the body. In fact, I don't think there's a part of the body that doesn't have a food named after it, or very few anyway.
Uh-huh.
They're the obvious ones, of course, like elbow macaroni and black-eyed peas and things like that. Ladyfingers, of course, which are shaped like a lady's fingers. But if you get into other food names, it gets to be a whole lot of fun. Linguini comes from the Italian for little tongues because they're long and flat, and there are a lot of wonderful Italian pasta names. There's, as you know, umbilici sacri, which is a name for a kind of tortellini, which literally means sacred navels. You know, so I can never eat a plate of tortellini now without thinking of belly buttons. Lasagna is another one that supposedly got its origin from an old Roman word for chamber pot. There are also a lot of really interesting foods that got their names because of mishaps or mistranslations or misunderstandings. A case in point being Jordan almonds, which you would assume come from Jordan, but
right. Actually
they come from Spain.
What are some of the other categories you ended up putting things into?
Well, a lot of the food names sorted themselves out into foods that are named for people and places, for example.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of restaurateurs name foods after themselves or after a particularly well-heeled customer. That happened in the case of, say, Eggs Benedict and Bananas Foster, which, interestingly enough, is probably the only dessert that I know of that is named after an awning salesman. In the 1950s in New Orleans at the restaurant Brennan's, there was a fellow who frequented the restaurant, and his name was Mr. Foster, and he sold awnings for a living. And the chef there created a dessert in his honor called Bananas Foster. At the Delmonico's restaurant in New York, there was a dish that was originally called Lobster Wenberg. It was named after a patron, Benjamin Wenberg, who came to the restaurant and suggested that they come up with this very rich lobster creamy dish. And they named it after Mr. Wenberg. And so for a while, customers were enjoying this dish called Lobster Wenberg, but things went kind of badly because Mr. Wenberg ended up in some kind of drunken brawl in the posh dining room. Nobody knows exactly what happened there, but the restaurateur was so upset with Mr. Wenberg that he wanted to change the name of this dish that he had named after him. Unfortunately, however, the dish was already so popular among customers that he didn't want to change the name too much, so he just switched the letters around from Lobster Wenberg to what we now know as Lobster Newberg.
That's how Lobster Newberg got its name. Huh.
Isn't that wonderful?
Are there any unexpected origins for food names? Things that we would just never dream are the origins of a food's name?
Well, getting back to parts of the body that have inspired food names, you might think twice about eating an avocado if you realize that it comes from the Aztec's word for testicle.
I don't know if we want to go there.
The Aztecs actually considered it as an aphrodisiac. And interestingly enough, the Aztecs word for sauce, mole, which gives us the Mexican sauce that we know today as mole, they put that word together with their word for avocado, ahuacatl. So it turned out to be ahuacatl mole, which eventually gave us guacamole.
What about pumpernickel? That's always been a funny word to me. Where does that come from?
Well, it is a funny word, and I'm afraid its origin is not all that appetizing. The pumpern in pumpernickel comes from an old German word that, let's see, how can we say this? It's a verb involving flatulence. And
really? Okay. And the nickel? And
the nickel in pumpernickel is an old word for devil. Sometimes you'll see the devil referred to in English as Old Nick. And apparently the joke that was going around Germany about pumpernickel was that this bread was so dark and coarse and strong that it would induce flatulence in the devil himself.
I don't think I'm ever going to look at this in quite the same way. Have you got a favorite term that you ran across?
I sure do. It's a Dutch term, and the Dutch have some wonderful, wonderful names for food. But this one is particularly picturesque. Now, you have to picture this in your mind. It's a dish of string beans and navy beans. Okay, you got that?
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, it's called Blautabilities in Het Gras. You have to
you have to translate this, Martha. I'm sorry, but I have to really do a translation, okay?
Okay. It's a dish of string beans and navy beans. It's called Blautabilities in Het Gras. And literally, that means bare buttocks in the grass. You know, if there's a more picturesque food name, I don't know it. Maybe your listeners will call in with one. But that's the one that I want to take on a picnic one of these days.
I can't think of anything more graphic than that. Martha, thank you.
Sure.
Martha Barnett is author of Lady Fingers and Men's Tummies, a lighthearted look at how foods got their names. To get information on her book, go to our website at splendidtable.org. Bill Waddington is a tea merchant, and I'm in training with Bill. Once a month, he brings in new teas for me to taste. Now, last time we tasted green teas. What are we doing this time, Bill?
It seemed to make sense to move up to oolong teas, which are the next kind of step in terms of the oxidation levels of teas. Black teas are 100% oxidized. Green teas are not oxidized. Oolong teas are partially oxidized, so they exist between the worlds of black and green.
Now, when you say oxidized, you mean dried and fermented?
A lot of people use the phrase fermenting for teas. Actually, no fermentation occurs. The chemical process that occurs is oxidation. And really, in layman's terms, they let the leaf sit exposed to the atmosphere for a number of hours, and a couple things happen. The water evaporates out of the leaf, mm-hmm. and the leaf absorbs extra oxygen from the atmosphere, hence the name oxidation. And that causes the leaf to be darker, to wither a little bit, and for the brew to be stronger, more robust, and have a higher caffeine content.
All right, so the oolongs are sort of halfway between the green tea, which isn't oxidized, and the black teas that are oxidized.
Exactly. They exist between the two.
Okay. All right, so what are we actually tasting?
We're going to try two oolongs today. One's called Green Dragon Oolong, and one's called a Fancy Silvertip Oolong.
I love these names.
They are kind of amazing sometimes. The world of oolongs is huge because you can have oolongs that are very, very close to green teas,
mm-hmm.
relatively light and subtle, and you can have oolongs that are very, very close to black teas that are more robust, darker flavor, deeper flavors to it. So that's one of the fascinating things to me about oolongs. It's an incredibly complicated world of itself. And that was the timer for some teas here.
Are these from China?
Both of these oolongs are from Formosa or Taiwan. And a lot of people believe that the world's best oolongs come from Formosa. That's oolongs originated in Formosa as opposed to China.
Oh, interesting.
But the reality is nowadays there are many fine oolongs being produced in China, and even India and Sri Lanka, Ceylon, over the last 10, 15 years have started experimenting with producing oolongs.
Now, you've been brewing these for how long?
I brewed these both for about 3 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes. And I also used a water temperature that was a little bit less than boiling, water temperature that was around 190 to 195 degrees. So again, it's between greens and blacks. It's a little bit warmer than green tea water, which is around 170 to 180.
Right.
And it's less than the boiling water used for black tea.
So would this mean I take the kettle off the heat after it boiled and just let it sit for a minute?
A minute to 2 minutes, that would work.
Okay, and then pour it into the tea.
And then pour it into
And brew it for 3 minutes.
Brew it for 3 minutes. Although the brewing time for oolongs, not to complicate things, can vary dramatically, depending on the leaf. If it's a very large-leafed oolong, which is real common, many oolongs have a very large leaf.
Okay.
And after you brew it, you can even unfurl the leaf and see how big it is. If it's a large-leafed oolong, you brew it for a longer time because it takes longer to infuse that whole leaf.
Okay, that's a great tip. The bigger the leaf with the oolong, the longer you brew it.
And that actually applies to just about any tea. If you have a very fine, almost a dust-like tea, you want to brew it a very short amount of time because there's more surface area exposed to water. If you have a whole leaf, and even a big whole leaf, you need to brew it for a longer amount of time because there's less actual surface area exposed to the water.
Okay.
So, I have a couple teas here to try. The first one I'd suggest you try is the Green Dragon Oolong.
The Green Dragon Oolong. Now, this is an amber color.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like absolutely clear, fat-free, obviously, chicken broth.
Oh.
I mean, it's golden. It's beautiful. All right. Mmm. It has a little hint of smokiness. It has, now, this is interesting. When we tasted green teas, I kept saying they reminded me of the sea. They had a limpid, silky quality on the tongue, and they weren't salty, but they had a clean quality. There's still that sense of that clean ocean quality, the way ocean air smells. There's a hint of that taste in this tea, but then there's also this very subtle smokiness. This is really a tea to think about. I mean, I'd like to sip this very quietly, you know, it's sort of a contemplative tea.
Absolutely, it's a good description of it. It's a very low oxidized oolong. It's only undergone about 18% oxidation, so it's not that far away from a green tea.
Okay, all right, this is lovely. It's very gentle.
That's a good description of it also. Second tea that we're going to try is called a Fancy Silvertip Oolong.
Does it really have silver tips?
It does indeed. In fact, you can see them here, I think.
Hey, you're right. There are little white tips on top of these kind of dried, curled, brown strands of tea. Now, this is completely different. This is a brown amber color, still absolutely clear. It has that sheen, that limpid quality that the other one has. You would never think that these were both the same kind of tea.
The world of oolongs is huge.
Oh, now this is interesting. This tea tastes like a very light black tea, you know, the kind of tea we make with a tea bag, in the sense of the tea I drink every day, or I used to drink every day before I met you. This tastes like a very delicate version of that.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's the smokiness isn't as prevalent. I mean, the other one had that subtle quality of smoke.
Sure.
This just, it tastes rather mellow, very pleasing. Not something you want to think about as much as this other one. This other one's the tea you keep sipping and rolling around in your mind.
One other thing that should definitely be mentioned with oolongs is good oolong teas are meant to be brewed multiple times. The flavor doesn't diminish as you brew, and by that I mean you brew the same leaves a second
again and
time,
again?
A third time, a fourth time. The flavor doesn't diminish as you go, it evolves, and part of the joy of oolongs is to see what happens to the taste through the second, third, fourth brewing. The Green Dragon oolong that you're drinking right now in the store, we brewed that for some folks who stopped by the store, and we brewed it 8 separate times, and I made them take notes at each brewing to see how the taste changed. And we stopped at 8, not because we ran out of flavor, we ran out of time. And most of the folks enjoyed the 4th or the 6th brewings of the same leaves the best. It brought out the most flavor out of them.
Not only is that interesting to hear, but that also is great for the amount of money we spend on teas.
It makes what seems like an expensive tea a heck of a lot more affordable, that's for sure.
Okay, so the two names of the teas
are Green Dragon Oolong.
Right.
And Fancy Silvertip Oolong.
Okay.
Both from Formosa.
Bill, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Lynn.
Tea merchant Bill Waddington is proprietor of Tea Source in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can get Bill's selection of oolong teas two ways. Either mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota,
800-288-55101 or go to our website at splendidtable.org. Now, if you miss those addresses, don't worry. I'm going to repeat them at the end of the show.
Hello. Get my number.
It's that time. We're taking your calls this hour, and the lines are open. The number is 1-800-537-5252. Anything you want to talk about, I'll give it a shot. So let's get to the phones. We've got Philip on the line. Hi, Philip.
Hello.
Hello there. What's on your mind, Philip?
Well, some months ago, you gave instructions on how to roast garlic, and I lost the instructions, and I forgot them. My mind just has gone completely blank.
We understand that, Philip. We really understand about minds going blank. Real simple and basic. Set your oven at about 400 degrees, and then take your whole heads of garlic. And I like to use organic garlic. That way I don't have to worry about, you know, the pesticides and the fertilizers and all that other stuff. And buy large-headed garlic. Just because it's easier to handle, you know. I don't mean elephant garlic. I just mean garlic with large cloves in it. Lop off the top quarter of the head of garlic. Save it. You're going to, you know, chop that and use it and stuff. And then arrange your whole heads of garlic in a shallow baking dish of some kind. I mean, it could just be an aluminum foil pan, or it could be a pretty baking dish, depending on how you want to present it. And then add to the pan either a little broth or a little water. You need a quarter of an inch maybe in the bottom of the pan. And sprinkle the top of the garlic heads with a little olive oil and sprinkle them with salt and pepper. Cover them with foil, put them in the oven, and roast them about 45 minutes and then uncover and roast in another 15 minutes or until you can easily pierce the garlic with a knife. And that's it. You're home free.
Sounds wonderful. The garlic is here waiting.
Oh, good. I can hear it sitting there saying, take me, I'm yours.
Yes.
Yeah, and don't waste your money on those silly garlic roasters. I mean, they're pretty.
I have a little Pyrex pan, dish I bought for that.
Just swell.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Roasted garlic. Oh, yes, I like this. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge, and today's question is, what two spices are the outside and the inside of the same thing? Muse that one for a bit. Again, the question is, what two spices are the outside and the inside of the same thing? More of your calls in a moment. The number is 1-800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 1-800-537-5252, but before getting to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, what two spices are the outside and the inside of the same thing? The answer is mace and nutmeg.
Mace is the dried areal, or it's sort of a web-like cage that surrounds the nutmeg seed. Now, both spices are good in creamy desserts like custards and cheese dishes and an apple pie and spice cake. Supposedly, nutmeg can be a narcotic in large quantities, but large quantities of nutmeg taste pretty awful, so getting high on baked custard is really not going to happen. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Try us at 1-800-537-5252. We've got Pat on the line. Hi, Pat. What's up?
Hi. I've got a question for you about vanilla.
Okay.
I was recently in Paris, and I'm an addict of markets. And at a street market, I picked up some bourbon extra vanilla.
Yeah.
And I've heard...
You mean the extract or the beans or what?
Well, I picked up two things. One thing that I picked up was the beans, and I've worked with beans before, so I know how to handle those.
Right.
But I also picked up a powdered vanilla. It's not an extract. It's a brown powder.
Oh.
And I have no idea how to figure out how much of this to use.
All right.
Exactly what it is.
It smells incredible, right?
Smells great.
Yep. All right. What you've got is, if it's what I remember this as being, and I used to be able to buy it in Paris, it's ground vanilla.
Ah, great. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, it's ground beans. It's extraordinarily intense. And if a recipe calls for, let's say, a teaspoon of vanilla extract, you'd want to use the amount of this that you could hold on the tip of a paring knife, which I guess would work out to be maybe something like a 1/16 of a teaspoon.
Great.
Very tiny amount. And the beauty part of this ground vanilla is that it's more, even more complex than most vanilla extracts, because you've got the whole pod, so you get all the different tastes you would get from the seed and the aromatic pod. It's really gorgeous stuff.
The smell is incredible.
It is absolutely incredible. I mean, I have actually, you know how some people take things to pick them up
mm-hmm.
when they're feeling flagged? Well, I used to sniff vanilla. And it is, I used to, when I had this stuff as part of my life, because I've never found it here in the United States, it's the best thing, a little vial of it in your purse, you know, and just take a whiff when you need a little bounce. But the thing is, keep it in the freezer.
Okay.
Because it's real volatile, and I found that I could keep mine for about a year and a half in the freezer, and it held up pretty well.
Oh, that's great.
Okay.
Now, the beans, actually, the guy that I bought them from was telling me that if you look closely, they're actually tiny little crystals forming on the outside of the beans.
That's right.
And they said that was actually crystallized vanilla. Is that true?
That's right. When, you know, the process by which vanilla is made, it's a pod of a member of the orchid family. It's the pod of a plant. And evidently what they do is they pick the pod and then they wrap the vanilla beans together. And there's a fermentation process that happens. And these white crystals
right.
form on the outside, and it's called, I think, vanillin,
mm-hmm.
and that white powder is, or that white crystal, is also marketed. There's also an imitation one that's called the same name. It looks exactly the same, and it's ghastly stuff. It's terrible. It's cheap vanilla flavor. You don't want it in your life. But yes, that will have a wonderful flavor. It sounds like your pods are still fermenting.
Well, they said that if I kept them in the... And this little, they gave it to me in a little, like, test tube kind of thing.
Yes, that's the way it's sold.
And they said if I kept it in there, that it would continue to grow those little...
Those little crystals can be delicious, can be wonderful. Scrape them off.
Can I ask one last question?
Sure.
What exactly is bourbon vanilla versus other vanilla?
If I remember correctly, there's vanilla is grown in Mexico. It's grown, as I recall, in Madagascar. There's Tahitian vanilla, which is very hard to get a hold of these days. It's a different kind of vanilla. And I think the Bourbon, it
uh-huh.
comes, by the way, from the name of the French royal family.
Uh-huh.
They were Bourbons.
Uh-huh.
And I think that is the kind of vanilla bean, and it's considered a high grade of, or a high quality vanilla bean that comes from Madagascar.
Right.
I say I think because I may be a little foggy on it, but it's not the Mexican one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a very good quality vanilla.
Well, thank you.
Well,
it's,
thank you.
It's a great thing to bring back from Paris.
Treasure them because they're really delicious.
Thank you.
And take a sniff now and then.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
This idea of
having aromatics in our lives. I really think we miss out on something. You know, we buy these room deodorizers and all this other stuff, and you could use, you know, we've heard about bay leaves in the closet. You could keep things like fresh crushed cloves in a bowl in the house. They smell great. Or take allspice and just, you know, crush them with your knife, the handle of a knife, just to get that aroma. I don't think you need room deodorizers. Start using spices. And if you've got this great vanilla, why not? And try sniffing. I'm for sniffing. Just do it with natural substances that are not harmful and not habit forming. Erica's on the line. Hi, Erica. What's happening?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm fine. What's going on?
Well, I listen to your show all the time, and I had a question. It's going to sound very basic, but when I go into the store, I'm very confused. It's about salt.
Yeah.
When I go into the store, there are millions of boxes of salt these days. It used to be just the Morton's table salt in a little round container.
Right.
Now there is light salt, sea salt, table salt, kosher salt, all these different salts with or without iodine, fine versus coarse. I need a crash course.
Well, it's, you know, this is really, this is not a stupid question. This is a very good question, and a lot of us get confused. We're going to break this down into some of the basics. Iodized table salt, kosher salt, and sea salt. Because I think that's going to more or less, I don't know what light salt is, but I don't want it in my body. That stuff tastes like a chemical factory. Let's put that aside. Okay?
Okay.
Iodized salt is a salt that's mined from the land as opposed to sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That has iodide added to it. And this comes from the days when people who lived away from the coastal areas sometimes had problems with goiters because they had no iodide in their diet.
Okay.
And they started adding this to salt. It's one of the very commonly available salts. It's inexpensive. It's the salt most of us know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, kosher salt also comes from the land, but its structure is different. If you could look under a microscope at that salt with the iodide in it, most table salt, it looks like a cube.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the crystal looks like.
Okay.
But evidently, kosher salt is made in two different processes, and I'm not going to confuse you, but one brand has one structure, and another brand has another structure. But evidently, the comparison would be, if your table salt is a cube, kosher salt looks like a snowflake.
Okay.
And it's very light. So if you have a tablespoon of kosher salt and a tablespoon of table salt, the kosher salt will weigh less, and that's why people say it's not as salty tasting.
Ah.
There's less of it.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it usually doesn't have things added to it. It may have a non-caking agent, but that's about it.
Okay.
Sea salt is evaporated salt from seawater. You evaporate away the seawater.
Right.
And this is a case where the flavor will change according to where it comes from, because obviously there are different micro substances from one body of water to another. So you can have a sea salt that tastes like sweet. I know of a sea salt I've tasted that tastes like roses.
Really?
It has, and it's a fascinating salt, and another one that tastes quite hot and strong in the mouth.
Huh.
Now, connoisseurs of salt tend to like to cook with kosher salt because it's not expensive. It has a pure salt taste. And when they're throwing salt into a pot of boiling water for pasta or flavoring a soup, anywhere where the salt's going to dissolve,
uh-huh.
they'll use sometimes a kosher salt or a good quality sea salt.
Okay.
But there is one other kind of sea salt out there. This is the Rolls Royce of salts.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, brace yourself. You really wanted to know how to spend $45 for a pound of salt, right?
Tell me about it.
Yeah, this is why you call the Splendid Table. We always find this stuff. You want to go broke? You listen to the show.
Okay.
But the thing is, there is a salt, and it's been getting a lot of publicity over the past couple of years. It comes from an island off the coast of Brittany. This mm-hmm. is France. And it is called fleur de sel, which means the flower of the salt.
Okay.
Now, what that is as the seawater starts to evaporate, evidently the first crystals that form as the water begins to recede, mm-hmm. the first salt crystals, have a very fragile structure and a very delicate flavor, and it's called the flower of the salt, fleur de sel, like a blossom.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that all the publicity, this salt, especially this salt from this particular island off the coast of Brittany, was just a lot of hoo-ha. You know, we were hearing French chefs loved it, et cetera. Very expensive. Well, by gum, the stuff is delicious.
Is it?
And it tastes not only delicious when you taste it, it tastes sweet and complex. But when you, and you add it to things at the end of cooking, they don't actually throw it in the pasta water. It's too expensive.
Oh, no.
But it's really complex. It's like a great, you know, like drinking a great brandy.
Uh-huh.
It has a lot of complexity to it. And you take something simple like boiled green beans and toss and salt them with this, and it's just delicious. So if you want to have your Rolls Royce salt, I keep a little jar of it, and I use it only on special occasions.
I see.
But I would say try sea salts, because you're going to find a lot of good ones out there, and taste them. I find iodized salt now, for me, tastes, it burns me. I don't like the taste anymore, but that's because I've been tasting these other things.
Right.
And if you come to my house, we have salt tastings.
Well, you know, I'll be there.
Yeah, well, you know, as someone said to me, I really do have to get a life one of these days. But in the meantime, I'll keep tasting salt.
Well, thank you so much.
Hey.
Because I was so confused when I walked into the store, and it's just like there's so many different kinds. So I'll have to save up my ducats and try the Rolls Royce.
Well, yeah, and in between, you know, the price of the Rolls Royce and the rest of them, you're going to find some things that are very affordable.
Great.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Now, I understand getting this carried away about salt is a little strange, but if you stop and think about it for a minute, this is one of the things we use in everything. And I, by the way, I'm really not hot on this whole idea of salt-free. If the doctor says to you, you can't eat salt, that's one thing. But salt is the joy of food. I mean, food comes alive with salt. And if you think about these ingredients that we live with every single day, why not look for great examples of them? My little $14 jar is going to last a very long time of my fleur de sel. That's $14 for something like a quarter of a pound, by the way. Look, we're all a little crazy. This is my craziness. Okay, let's get back to reality. With all this talk of the farm situation of late, we thought it'd be a good idea to check in with a farmer from time to time over the next couple of months, keep our fingers on the pulse, and remind us of, well, where our food comes from. Tom Franson is a farmer in Chickasaw County, Iowa, who raises hogs and beef on 235 acres. Hi, Tom. What are you doing today?
Well, I did my chores this morning first, but we have got a small alternative marketing initiative that we started a few months ago, and we had a kind of a crisis meeting this morning because the gal that was really doing the program for us got a different job, and she quit very suddenly.
What do you mean by an alternative market?
Oh, we're raising hogs that meet some real strict criteria from the humanitarian standpoint, and we are marketing them in some special markets.
Ah, so you mean these are hogs that are raised differently than what we normally get?
Yes. They meet the standards set by the Animal Welfare Institute in regards to humane treatment of the livestock.
Uh-huh.
And they meet very strict standards on both genetics and drug use.
So they're what we might call a happy pig?
Oh, we would sure think that. Yeah, we would definitely say that because there is no slat floors allowed. There's no inhumane treatment allowed, and they also have to have the type of carcass quality that's preferred by consumers. It meets some real strict standards.
Uh-huh. Well, what's going on the farm today?
I planted a lot of small grains, and last week was just an excellent week. Basically, I'm not 100% organic, and time it will be. See, I have a five-year rotation, and so it's kind of critical for me to get the small grains in the ground this spring because that's where the rotation begins on this farm. In other words, to move into organic, you start with seeding land down to oats, followed by a hay crop.
Oh, so there's actually a procedure that you go through that you plant things?
A very specific one that has to be thought through and plotted out well in advance. It's really almost fairly rigid.
Huh. So each year you're planting something different so that it rotates through? And
definitely. And for most of the land here, about two-thirds of the land, the rotation is corn, soybeans, oats, hay, and pasture in that sequence.
So are there any big worries right now that you have, like this week? I mean, is there some problem that's facing you because of the weather?
Well, I got the small grain in the ground in the best condition I've ever seen, just ideal planting conditions, and that has to be done early in the spring. So that's the big one. The cow-calf herd starts having calves now, and of course I'd like to have a little better weather than we have right now, but we had really good weather last week.
Uh-huh.
So little things like that. There's always things when you get into April and May that'd be concerned.
Is there anything that can happen with the weather in the near future that really you don't want to see happen?
Yeah. In 1990, I had the small grains planted very early, and shortly after they emerged, we got down to 10 degrees Fahrenheit air temperature with bare soil. And believe me, I took care of it, and I killed about two-thirds of it.
Wow.
So I've seen that happen. You don't want extremely low temperatures on bare soil with emerging crops. It can be very hard on them.
Tom, we're going to keep our fingers crossed for you, and thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to visit with you, Lynn, and I'll talk to you more down the road. There's a lot of things we can talk about.
Okay. Take care.
Okay.
Tom Franson farms in Chickasaw County, Iowa, and we're going to be checking with him all through the growing season. Okay, let's get back to the phones. We've got Jennifer on the line. Jennifer, what's happening?
Hi. We bought a refurbished O'Keefe Merit stove, and they chrome-plated the griddle, the pancake griddle.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if that's going to be okay to eat from. Can we use it? And if not, what could we do to change that?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, chromium is a hard, brittle metal or alloy. And by the way, it's what's added to steel, from what I understand, to essentially make stainless steel.
Oh, uh-huh.
But I'm not sure about cooking just on chromium. I'm a little worried because it's evidently quite brittle, and I'm worried it might flake.
Oh, uh-huh.
Again, I've never run into this before, but I think the only thing you can... This is a built-in griddle on the top of the stove.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Because what you really would want is something like cast iron.
Right.
Yeah.
It was made, you know, whatever the old stoves were.
Right.
And then they chrome-plated it to make it look shiny and new.
Oh, why don't people leave well enough alone? I would say give it back to them. The griddle's removable, right?
Right.
Yeah. I would say please, if they could, to find some way of removing that chromium, because I would imagine that original griddle would be cast iron.
Okay.
Yeah, because I don't think I'd like to cook on that.
Okay.
I'd be just a little bit concerned.
All right.
All right?
Great.
And
thanks
enjoy the
so
new
much.
Stove. You take care.
I love your show.
Hey, thank you. And so long. Well, that's it for today, folks. Take care, everybody. Thanks for being with us today, and do join us next week. In the meantime, let me leave you with Jean-Jacques Rousseau's definition of happiness: a good bank account, a good cook, and good digestion. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest in cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders and ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get a copy of the Stearns Roadside Food Finds and information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.